In 86, if the president wants military advice, he need only turn to a man in statute called his principal military advisor, who's the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So he has military advice. Not a question of giving him military advice. It's a question of putting a necessary professional deformation towards military and kinetic operations in charge of the civilian control in the department. As I say, in a Latin American country, we'd say this is ill-advised.
Now, I think General Flynn will be with Trump today as he gets briefed. He doesn't need approval. He's one of the ones who pushed the idea of the child sex trafficking ring that he said Hillary Clinton was involved with and that she had declared war on the Catholic Church. We just have 15 seconds.
Yeah, General Flynn is not unusual. Because we've had Colin Powell, Brent Scowcroft as national security advisors. Not unusual to have a military person. He just seems temperamentally ill-suited to a job, which is to arrange the options for the president and give a relatively neutral array of choices to the commander-in-chief.
We'll leave it there. Gordon Adams, professor emeritus at American University's School of International Service, distinguished fellow at the Stimson Center. His latest book, Mission Creep. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5 o'clock. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the first annual David Bowie Memorial Bike Ride on his birthday, Sunday, January 8th. Come ride your bike around Portland with Diablo as we celebrate the life and music of David Bowie with a mobile dance party and sing-along. Again, that's the first annual David Bowie Memorial Bike Ride on January 8th at 3 p.m. at the Bowie Bike Lane at the corner of Southwest Broadway and Main in downtown Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of First 100 Days, United in Resistance. First 100 Days is a resource to support creative resistance to the Trump regime and takes place January 14th and 15th at the Portland Institute for Contemporary Art. There will be workshops on preparing for protests, interrupting oppression, creative protest tactics, and more, with the goal of strengthening our communities by channeling outrage into dynamic projects based on a deeper analysis of anti-colonial, anti-capitalist, anti-racist, and feminist histories. Again, that's First 100 Days, January 14th and 15th, at the Portland Institute for Contemporary Art, 415 Southwest 10th Avenue, Suite 300 in Portland. More information on the event can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a former U.S. attorney who worked on the prosecution of Native American activist Leonard Peltier has sent the president a written request for clemency.
The threat of mass deportations by the incoming Trump administration has brought renewed interest in the sanctuary movement. KBOO's Stacy Holtzman speaks with Rayanne LaFrenz of the Oregon Sanctuary Movement.
And KBOO's Don Merrill speaks with incoming Oregon Secretary of State Dennis Richardson.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, January 6, 2017. I'm Linda Olson Osterlund.
And I'm Liam Delta. It's not just cities and schools that are stepping up as sanctuaries to protect immigrants in their communities. Churches are doing this also. The sanctuary movement was born during the 1980s when churches took in Central American refugees that were fleeing American-funded civil wars. Oregon's churches have a history in this movement with cases such as Francisco Aguirre. Augustana Lutheran Church in Portland provided him sanctuary for 81 days before his deportation charges were dropped. The sanctuary movement is being reactivated with the Trump administration's threat of mass deportations. Churches can play a special role because the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency does not enforce actions at sensitive locations such as schools and churches unless given special approval under urgent situations. KBOO's Stacey Holtman spoke to an organizer about the Oregon Sanctuary Movement and how the interfaith community plans to protect immigrants facing deportation.
Hi, welcome to KBOO. Can you tell us who you are and what organization you work with?
Sure. My name is Ray Ann LaFrenz, and I'm the coordinator for the Interfaith Movement for Immigrant Justice here in Portland, Oregon.
What is a sanctuary church?
Sanctuary can be many different things, especially when we're faced with this this new political reality. Sanctuary can be supporting, it can be offering, it can be accompaniment on many different levels as well. What it is not is harboring criminals. A lot of people feel that they might be courting some sort of legal problems, but the truth is that, you know, when you have unjust laws, your reaction needs to be swift and energetic and radical to protect people from persecution. You know, here in the United States, immigrant rights is in many ways the vanguard for human rights, where everything comes together. Immigrants and refugees are one of the most oppressed and persecuted populations in this entire country.
Who is coming together?
These are people who are coming from every faith tradition you can possibly imagine. Their conscience speaking to them, you know, their faith tradition dictating that they welcome and love their neighbor. And that's pretty fascinating that, you know, crosses pretty much every faith tradition you can think of.
How can people get involved with this movement?
I would, you know, refer people to this Sunday's event on January 8th at the Oregon Sanctuary Assembly, which starts at 3 o'clock p.m. at First Christian Church downtown. That's a good place to start because that's where you'll connect with people, like-minded people, people who have questions and people who are curious about what sanctuary might be.
Can people come who want to help provide sanctuary but are not affiliated with a faith-based organization?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. No, and I think, you know, one thing about, you know, when you hear the word faith or faith-based or interfaith is it's inclusive, not exclusive. And so many of our members, many of the people who are involved and many of our strongest supporters during the sanctuary movement are people who are not affiliated with a particular church. I'm the director of this organization and I don't go to a church.
Why is it important that people show up for our immigrant community members?
Oh my gosh, you know, that this year it can be overwhelming, you know, what's coming down. I think a lot of people have expressed this sort of fear that things might become normalized. And so, instead of giving into that fear, you know, it's going to become normal, we're going to forget how unjust this is and how Trump's politics are going to be oppressive. We need to make sure that we are connecting with our neighbors, connecting with each other, because we are the ones who are giving ourselves energy and support. Without each other, we can't do this. And so I really hope that people are staying connected with the sanctuary movement and with local organizations who are working for immigrants' rights. And if we can donate your time, do it. We need all the help we can get.
This is KBOO's Stacey Holtman with Ray Ann LaFrenz of the Interfaith Movement for Immigrant Justice.
Multnomah County Judge Stephen Bushlong ruled Thursday that Portland was free to spend tens of millions of dollars in sewer revenue to address pollution in the Willamette River's Portland Harbor. The city has spent $58.2 million on the Superfund project since 2001. Of that, $50.6 million was paid by sewer customers through a surcharge on their bills. The ruling means Portland won't have to pay back those utility customers, sparing officials from a major budget headache in Mayor Ted Wheeler's first year. Bushlong said Portland had correctly spent the surcharge funds on the Portland Harbor project and on other nonprofit work, but the city should not use that money on parks programs. Thursday's ruling comes a day before the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is expected to release a final plan for cleaning the harbor, which is expected to cost at least $746 million.
Dennis Richardson was sworn in as the new Oregon Secretary of State last week. Richardson is the first Republican to hold the office since Norma Paulus in 1985. KBOO's Don Merrill spoke to Richardson after the ceremony.
So as Secretary of State, I will be, you know, focusing on all four aspects, really. You know, the the auditing division to help ensure that people's money is well spent, the corporations division to help ensure that we're welcoming to businesses, that we listen to Oregon businesses that are having difficulties and try and remove unnecessary regulations, that we ask ourselves the question, if this regulation was not in existence but was being considered today, would we create it? And if the answer is no, then why do we have it? And those kinds of questions are very infrequently asked. And then when it comes to the archives division, that is kind of a quiet place, but it's very important because that's where the records of our state are held. One of the first things that we're going to do is to promote finalizing a constitutional project where we raise the money independently to display the Oregon Constitution for the public to see. I mean, it needs to be safe and secure, and it needs to be where the people can see it. And so that's something that's been discussed and been kind of going forward, but now we'll bring it about. So I'm excited about these opportunities. And then the audits division needs to do more than just ensure that we are complying with standard accounting practices and actually track the people's money. And so in the past, when there's been controversial issues, the attitude was, that's not our job to deal with that. We'll audit other things because the legislature will do the oversight. Well, having been in the legislature, they don't have the capacity, really, to do what the audits division can. And so we'll work in conjunction with the Legislative Joint Audits Committee, and we'll have a group of our auditors, when there's something that is controversial or very expensive, we'll follow it. We'll look at it from the beginning, and if there's money that seems to have been wasted, we'll track down what happened, who's accountable, what can we learn from it so it doesn't just keep reoccurring, which has happened for 2.5 decades with IT projects that the state takes on. So anyway, I think that if we're able to do the job the way it's supposed to be done, we will be able to restore trust that in state government there is an independent agency that's acting like a GAO, a government accountability office, that will not be paying attention to who's involved but what has occurred. And when things are done right, they should be applauded. And when things are not going right, then it needs to be exposed and dealt with. We'll send recommendations to the legislature and to the governor's office for them to take action. If we find that there's criminal problems, we will inform the right individuals under statute. It's not our job to prosecute or to go on witch hunts. It's our job to expose and help show what transparent government really is.
Mr. Secretary, do you think that being the first Republican in Oregon elected to office marks the beginning of a conservative shift for the state?
I don't think it's so much conservative versus liberal. I think my being elected was based on the fact that I had gained credibility by exposing the Kitzhaber scandals and making it a federal issue with a letter we sent to the federal prosecutor laying out the allegations. I think it led to a cleansing of that office. Corruption should not be allowed regardless of party. Party is not a factor when people are self-dealing from their positions. That's corrupt. And so the fact that there's Republicans that are delighted that a Republican won, they may be a little disappointed because they're not going to see me doing what they would like to see as a partisan action. They're going to see me be active as hopefully a good Secretary of State. And I've told them from the beginning, even in my speech when I was first elected on a campaign on election night, I said, you know, there are those of you that would like to see retribution. That's not going to happen with me. What you're going to see is honest government, and you won't be able to tell if there's a D or an R behind my name as Secretary of State.
That was KBOO's Don Merrill with incoming Oregon Secretary of State Dennis Richardson.
If proposed legislation moves forward during the upcoming legislative session, the Oregon Health Authority may soon lose its oversight of the state's medical marijuana dispensaries. OHA has regulated medical marijuana since 2014, while the Oregon Liquor Control Commission has overseen the recreational marijuana market since it was legalized by voters that same year. One draft legislative concept calls for OHA to transfer its duties and powers under the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act to a newly created Oregon Cannabis Commission. An alternative would prohibit OHA from registering marijuana grow sites, processing sites, and dispensaries. Oregon's attempts to create regulations hit a major snag this fall as tough new rules governing pesticide testing almost brought the industry to a standstill. There was a concern that a lack of product would fuel a return to the black market. The state's marijuana industry is in flux, with many dispensaries converting to retail-only sales. Since October 1st, 121 dispensaries have either surrendered their registration or withdrawn their applications, and the total number of dispensaries has dropped by about 25% statewide. In all, 18 legislative concepts propose changes to current rules on everything from possession by minors to employment rules.
Apparel manufacturer Chrome Industries has announced that they're relocating their company headquarters from San Francisco to Portland. The company is well known among bicycle enthusiasts as a manufacturer of messenger bags, shoes, and apparel. In a press release earlier this week, the company cited the opportunity to move the headquarters team closer to their Portland-based innovation lab. A company source also referenced the high cost of doing business in the Bay Area and pointed to the difficulty they have in attracting and retaining employees in an atmosphere where the cost of living is so high. The company currently has 21 employees at its San Francisco location. Chrome Industries is owned by the First Group. First also owns Keen Footwear, an apparel brand that is based in Portland.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin at 5:30, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather calls for a wintry mix of freezing rain and snow, with temperatures hovering around freezing throughout the Cascades and Inhood River. You can expect light snow on and off during the day, with temperatures in the mid-20s. On this day in 2001, Vice President Al Gore presided over a joint session of Congress that certified George Bush the winner of the presidential election. Gore won the popular vote but lost the Electoral College vote when the U.S. Supreme Court halted the Florida recount, handing the election to Bush. The quote is from American journalist and satirist H.L. Mencken, who said, quote, "Under democracy, one party always devotes its chief energies to trying to prove that the other party is unfit. Both commonly succeed and are right," end quote.
Now the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham. The U.S. Postal Service is ending post office services at Staples stores by March. The American Postal Workers Union protested the program for years, as about 500 Staples stores did postal work that post office employees used to provide. The APWU said the Postal Service was trying to privatize the work, using workers with much lower pay and worse benefits. APWU President Mark Demenstein says the union stood up against a wrong and won. When Republicans take government power in state houses, they attack labor unions and worker rights. Time and again, that has proven true over many years now. The latest example is in Kentucky, where Republicans have been trying to ram through an anti-union law with a misleading right to work name. It's an attack on the democratic decisions made by workers to require that union dues be paid in their workplaces. A majority of workers decide to unionize a workplace, and then a majority of those workers vote to approve contracts that require workers covered by the union contract to pay dues. Right to work laws
override that democratic decision by workers by outlawing that clause in their contracts. It allows some workers to freeload without paying dues, while the union is still required to represent them. Kentucky AFL-CIO President Bill Londrigan says these right-to-work laws are designed to undermine union resources, weakening workers politically. As Kentucky GOP Governor Matt Bevin testified in the legislature in support of the anti-worker, anti-union law, protesting workers loudly chanted, demanding to be let into the hearing room.
Working people matter! Working people matter! Working people matter!
No justice, no peace! No justice, no peace!
We want in! We want in!
Despite the worker protests, Kentucky is fast-tracking the anti-union bill. SEIU 1199 in Connecticut is urging state lawmakers and the governor there to enact a $15 an hour state minimum wage to help erase the state budget deficit. SEIU says a third of Connecticut's approximately $1.3 billion deficit is due to spending on low-wage worker public assistance. Corporations that pay these starvation wages cause a burden on state taxpayers. Governor Daniel Malloy wants state workers to give concessions to help ease the deficit, but SEIU says a better solution is to raise the minimum wage to $15 in Connecticut.
Brought to you by the California Teachers Association, 325,000 educators who know quality public schools make a better California for all of us. Information on how California teachers are shaping a stronger future for our kids is online at cta.org. Workers Independent News is proud to be heard on The Union Edge, Labor's Talk Radio. Live nationwide weekdays, noon to 3 p.m. at theunionedge.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
In November 2015, Seattle voters passed a citizen-led initiative known as Honest Elections Seattle, which enacted several campaign finance reforms. The reform allows the Seattle Ethics and Elections Commission to distribute democracy vouchers to eligible Seattle residents. Seattle is the first city in the nation to try this type of public campaign financing. Seattle residents get four $25 certificates they can use to support candidates running for Seattle City Council or City Attorney. Seattle voters approved a maximum property tax increase of $3 million per year to fund the Democracy Voucher Program for the next 10 years. The commission has begun to mail the vouchers to every registered voter and eligible resident in the city. That means more than 500,000 Seattleites will have $100 to support the candidates of their choice. A few weeks ago, Portland City Council approved open and accountable elections. This campaign funding reform allows candidates for city offices to receive a public match of 6-1 up to the first $50 of each individual campaign contribution.
The movement pushing President Barack Obama to offer clemency to Native American rights activist Leonard Peltier has gained a new ally. James Reynolds, a former U.S. prosecutor who worked on the case, has sent the president a written request for clemency. The letter was giving supporters of Peltier a glimmer of hope in the waning weeks of the Obama administration. FSRN's Sean Canaan has more.
A former U.S. attorney involved in the case against Leonard Peltier has now written an open letter to President Obama supporting his request for clemency. Peltier was convicted of killing two FBI agents in a 1975 shootout at the Pine Ridge Reservation, but has maintained his innocence for four decades. The shooting occurred during a time of intense indigenous rights organizing by the American Indian Movement, in which Peltier was active. Attorney James Reynolds supervised the government's legal team during an appeal in which Peltier's sentence and conviction were affirmed.
Yeah, I just thought that it was time. With all the circumstances that have gone down, both good and bad, it was maybe time to the president to grant clemency and the justice part of the case.
Reynolds says he's not making a statement about Peltier's guilt or innocence, just that after about 40 years, it's time for the 71-year-old to be released. Peltier is regarded as an elder and a political prisoner by a new generation of indigenous rights activists in the U.S. Peltier has written passionately about the current movement at Standing Rock, noting some of its leaders are veterans of the resistance at Pine Ridge, where a 71-day occupation of Wounded Knee ended with a pledge to investigate treaty abuses, a pledge that has yet to be fulfilled. Sean Canaan, FSRN, Tampa, Florida.
In a report that was unclassified earlier today, U.S. intelligence agencies stated again that Russia carried out an aggressive and comprehensive cyber campaign to influence the U.S. presidential election. The agency stated that the operation was ordered by Russian President Vladimir Putin and that the objective was to help elect Donald Trump by discrediting his Democratic opponent, Hillary Clinton. The report claims that the Russian campaign was unprecedented in overall scale and scope of activity and went well beyond previous election espionage. The report goes on to say that initially the attack was meant to, quote, denigrate Secretary Clinton, end quote. But as the presidential campaign proceeded, Russia developed, quote, a clear preference for the president-elect Trump, end quote. Putin has long been at odds with Hillary Clinton, who questioned the fairness of the 2011 election in Russia. He accused Clinton of encouraging Russian protesters who he claimed were being supported by the U.S. State Department. Donald Trump has repeatedly disparaged intelligence agency reports claiming that Russian hacking influenced the U.S. election. After a 90-minute meeting with intelligence agencies earlier today, he reversed his position, saying that the Russians had hacked the U.S. government, business, and organizational infrastructure, but insisted that the hacking had, quote, absolutely no effect on the outcome of the election, end quote.
The price of gasoline jumped by 20% on New Year's Day across Mexico, prompting ongoing nationwide protests and worries that the country's downward economic spiral may accelerate rapidly in the coming year. Shannon Young has more from Oaxaca.
Across Mexico, reaction to the sudden 20% hike in gasoline has ranged from peaceful picketing outside gas stations to fiery highway barricades and looting at big box stores. Confrontations have led to hundreds of arrests and the death of a police officer. The central Mexican city of Ixmiquilpan has become a flashpoint. Local residents there push back a huge deployment of police after officers allegedly fired live ammunition at protesters Thursday. The gas price hike is fueling deep economic anxiety in many Mexicans whose buying power has already plummeted, along with the exchange rate of the peso to the dollar. The peso has been in a three-year-long downward slump and has yet to recover from a steep drop against the dollar that occurred the day after the U.S. presidential election.
Este será un año de importantes retos.
In a pre-produced video speech released Thursday, Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto called for unity and understanding. He denied the gas hike is tied to the energy reform he championed in his first year in office. He also stressed the importance of good relations with the incoming U.S. administration as key to financial stability. But both U.S. President-elect Donald Trump and Peña Nieto's reform agenda are unpopular among wide sectors of the Mexican population. The gas price hike, known here as the gasolinazo, has revived past calls for President Peña Nieto to resign. But such demands remain more prevalent in the streets than in the chambers of government. Meanwhile, Mexican families that depend on remittances nervously watch events unfold ahead of Trump's inauguration. While Mexico's federal budget relies heavily on oil sales to keep the public sector running, the single largest source of revenue in the overall national economy comes from money transferred to Mexico from nationals living and working abroad, overwhelmingly in the United States. The Trump policy team has suggested targeting remittances as a way to generate revenue for the border wall the incoming president promised on the campaign trail. Just how the effects of the gas hike, peso plunge, promised mass deportations, and possible transfer taxes on remittances may affect the pocketbooks of Mexican families in the year to come remains to be seen. But this week, the anxiety already present was clearly visible in the streets around the country. Shannon Young, FSRN, Oaxaca.
Currently, there are 7 fossil fuel projects in different phases of approval around Oregon, but strong opposition to the projects has led to the cancellation or near death of 5 of the 7. The Portland Business Journal classified projects in Portland, Astoria, and Boardman, Oregon as, quote, dead, while projects in Coos Bay and Longview, that's Coos Bay, Oregon, and Longview, Washington, are on the ropes. However, 2 other projects, a proposed methanol refinery for Kalama, Washington, and an oil train terminal proposed for Vancouver, Washington, are considered still alive. Canceled projects include a proposed Pembina propane terminal for Portland was canceled by the City Council, a coal train proposal for Boardman, Oregon, was rejected by the Oregon Department of State Lands. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission rejected a pipeline and terminal license for Jordan Cove in Coos Bay. A liquid natural gas pipeline and terminal proposed for Astoria, Oregon, was withdrawn after strong local opposition, and the bulk coal terminal in Longview, Washington, is believed to be almost dead. Meanwhile, activists continue to fight the proposed methanol refinery in Kalama, Washington, and the Vancouver Oil Train Project, as well, and many worry that the dead projects are never quite dead, and with the Trump administration scheduled to invade the White House later this month, many of these earth-warming projects could be reheated. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Stacy Holtman, Theo Burke, Tom Flynn, Don Merrill, and Khalid Mosley. The producer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Free Speech Radio News. Our engineer is Jenna Yokoyama. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson-Osterland.
And I'm Liam Delta. Coming up Monday morning on KBOO at 7, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, More Talk Radio. Cecil and Celeste take your calls. At 9, social and political commentary from the Old Mole Variety Hour. Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia at 10, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15 on Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein welcomes the author of The Grid, The Fraying Wires Between Americans and Our Energy Future. At 11, Health Watch discusses the hidden cause behind a wide array of health problems with the author of The Thyroid Problem. And at 11:30, it's Between the Lines, a weekly radio news magazine. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. And now stay